thank you for coming to our first video gaming and religion seminar. My name is Heidi Campbell from Texas A&M University, and I will be kind of the chairperson slash wrangler of timekeeping today. Our theme today is crafting the study of religion and video games around table discussion on key perspectives. And I want to give a little background to the study of religion and gaming, especially in relation to this seminar, and as well as religion and gaming at the AAR. So in 2007 and then in 2010, there were different panels in which Greg Greve played a key role talking about religion and gaming. And this was really kind of important for the AAR of scholars, many young academics, and many young faculty working in these areas to begin to talk about how can we think of gaming as not just a form of entertainment, but a place of cultural practice and religious reflection. From that work, Greg Greve and some people that he was working with did some pioneering work on kind of starting to look at some of the themes and studies in religion and gaming. And from that came the first edited volume to really provide an overview of what we kind of know as far as through research on religion and gaming, Playing with Religion and Digital Gaming, which came out with Indiana University Press in 2014. And members of this panel were included in that volume, and then a larger group was gathered through the work of Kristen Red Antweiler and Zena Zelitzer just earlier this March, and the International Academy for the Study of Gaming and Religion was brought together. The aim of this group is to study and look really in depth in how gaming can become both a form of pedagogical practice within religious studies, as well as what kind of research methods and best practices have we learned at this point, and where further can we push the field, such as integrating work on Let's Plays and other forms of virtual platforms into the discussion. So today what we're going to be doing through that, and the work of the International Academy, we have a website in progress. This is our Facebook group. And we'll hear a little bit about Game Environments, the journal that's related to the association, the academies, in a few minutes. But the aim of this is to, the panel today, is to focus our discussion around three questions and through using Minecraft as a sandbox or thought experiment. So while Minecraft plays a key role in our discussions today, this panel is not about religion in Minecraft, but what we're going to be doing is using that as a discussion tool to talk about three important questions. First of all, we want to look at how the study of religion concerns itself with video games, and drawing on the expertise from a number of people that have been actively involved in this research area. Secondly, we're going to look at the methods and research questions that we recommend that need to be further pushed in this field that is still in its infancy. And then finally, we'll be coming together to talk about, do you have to play games to analyze them? A really important question for the Academy. Our panelists today include Jason Anderson, a journalist from Brooklyn, New York, Ian Bokos from Georgia Institute of Technology, a leader in game studies, Gregory Greve from the University of North Carolina, Greensboro, Owen Gottlieb from Rochester Institute of Technology, Kristen Red Antweiler from the University of Bremen, Michael Walter Matthew from RU Universitat Bochum, Rachel Wagner from Ithaca College, and Zena Zelitzer from University of Helsinki. And so without further ado, I'm going to pass it on to my colleague, Kristen, to give you some framework about the study of religion, especially in relation to Minecraft.
Okay, good morning, and thanks for all your coming. And I was asked to give a really, really short introduction to Minecraft. And by chance, who knows Minecraft?
Yes.
It's a little bit different here in our committee, but okay. Probably I can give the lecture for them, so you will be informed. So the problem, as we organized this seminar, we just asked ourselves, okay, we want to speak about theoretical concepts and methods, but we want to do it we want to put some flesh to the bone, so to speak. So we want to choose one game, and then we decided, okay, we take the game Minecraft. Minecraft is really common, especially for the younger generation, but of course, Minecraft is a good example because it's such a bad example in itself, because is Minecraft a game? And I think it's, therefore I choose this picture. I mean, Lego is a game, you can play with this, but is it a game in the sense that it has rules, that it has goals? So this, I think, is the problem with games, but not only with Minecraft in itself, but also in our definition, what do we want to analyze if we want to analyze video games or video gaming? And how do we define games? And I think this is an important question which hopefully come up in the next minutes or in the next discussion. So Minecraft is more like a kind of environment, I would say, where you have to buy this game and it's the person Notch or Marcus Persson, he's a Swedish person and he was quite successful as he in 2009 developed this game or this environment Minecraft. And what he did, it's a kind of Lego in a virtual world, so you can build with block, it's a building block system, it's an open sandbox kind of indie game. And he was so successful that in 2014 it was bought by Microsoft. Produced by the company Mojang for $2.5 billion. So you get an imagination that it's really, really successful in this field. And to make it really short, what is Minecraft? You have different modes, so you download this game on your computer and you can choose if you want to play it by your own, by yourself, just like you, or if you want to go on a special server and play with other games. You have different modes, for example, the creative mode where you can build everything you want or nothing you want. You have the survival mode. This is probably more than a video game is gaming as we know it, where you can have to fight against mobs, different mobs like creeper who explode to go too nearby, or zombies or spiders in the night. You have adventure mode and spectator mode, and you have also a different system about being in a peaceful area where no mobs are around, or in a so-called hardcore mob. So if you're being killed, then it's really the end of the game and you can't resurrect in a way. And I think, therefore, I was really reminded on Second Life. I don't know who knows Second Life, because it's a little bit similar. Because if you are looking who's doing all the stuff like maps or mods are modification for this game that you can download, so you don't only have a sword but a kind of machine gun from the Second World War, so everything is changed, or you have a kind of middle age surrounding, and it's always done by the player themselves. For example, I spoke yesterday with my 10-year-old son, and he said, "Oh, wonderful, you're giving an introduction about Minecraft. I can say such a lot of things." And also, this 10-year-old, and he's just an example, is just programming and developing servers so that other people and other gamers can play on this server. And I think this is the idea behind Minecraft. They're just giving us kind of tools, virtual Lego blocks or Lego bricks, and the gamer just making servers so other people can play mini games or other games. And I will just show you one example, because it's a nice introduction. Of course, it's an advertisement trailer, but probably you can have a good impression of what is Minecraft. Not working. But it's more than a sound. This is the problem. But probably I just reload it and then it will work, hopefully.
A man. It starts off black. It's for like a fight.
Okay, then I'll show you some pictures. This is probably the best solution because we're not so spending so much time. So as I said, you are having possibility in the creative models to build really cities, and you can find cities like New York, Berlin, Munich. And if we come to religious cities, of course, you can find the Vatican, for example, but also the Potok Temple from Lhasa. So there's a huge variety of religious temples and sceneries and cities where you can find it, and you can download it to your map or find it on different servers. Additionally, there are kind of mini games, and I just make some two most popular example. It's the first one, it's about jump and run. It's a typical jump and run play. You have to jump, and sometimes the dragon is following you, and sometimes you're just playing versus other players. And the other one in the other picture is a kind of Bed Wars, and you're playing with 2 to 65 people, where you have to destroy the beds of the others so the others can't resurrect. This is the goal of the game. There are mini games because there are approximately they last from 2 minutes to 1 hour. But of course, you have also other examples of having a game within a game. For example, there is a server where GameUp just built up World of Minecraft, and everybody knows it's of course based on World of Warcraft. So you have this whole World of Warcraft scenery, and you can play. You have quests on this server, so it's a game within this game environment. And also the other thing is from Skyrim, that you have also servers that people rebuild the Skyrim scenery, and you can just play these games on it. Just to give you a few examples. And of course it is, coming to the religious perspective, it's also used by different religious groups. For example, I give you one example for Minecraft Bible Lessons. It's from the Children's Ministry blog, and there is a small, not such a small community, but there's a community who uses Minecraft to teach biblical lessons within Minecraft. And here you see really the most explicit reflection on religion. But I think there are a lot of ways how we can research religion in this game or game environment. Okay, and of course you have a lot of advertisement thing. You can buy t-shirts, or you can buy costumes where people can dress themselves. For example, you see here an Enderman in the middle and a creeper just next to him. And what we have, and I think this is an interesting thing, I don't know if you know the YouTube scene, and especially the Let's Player scene, where people are playing games and filming themselves by camera and also within the game. And Minecraft was one of the reasons why the Let's Play scenery gets so important at the moment. And I just give you an example from a German Let's Player. Yeah, it's Gronk, and he's about have 2 million abos. And the, for example, the most successful YouTuber is a Let's Player called PewDiePie, and he's about, I think, 12 to 13 million abos at the moment. It's weird. You have to watch it. So, and they are playing a lot of Minecraft. PewDiePie not, but Gronk. So now we have to go back to the structure of this panel, and we will start with the first question. Yes, and that's it for the moment.
So just as a quick reminder to our panelists, for the first question, how should religious study concern itself with video games? We're going to have Ian, then Owen, then Michael, and then Jason respond. You have 3 minutes, and when you hear the digital ding, please wrap up your response. Ian.
Okay. Hello, everyone. I am not a scholar of religion. I'm familiar enough with this field, I guess, to get to sit up at the table. And so I'm not going to say much of anything about how religious studies should concern itself with games. It seems a little presumptuous, but I do have just one idea, which is that something about games, what games and religion might have in common.
Probably it's better to go to the
mic. All right. Well, for 3 minutes, it's going to be rough. Okay. That's better. All right. How much time do I have left now? No, 2 minutes. Great. Okay.
Survival mode.
Try to be a little more
consistent. Survival mode.
All right. It seems to me that the fundamental commonality between religion and games is not the content of religion so much as, you know, when you do Bible lessons in Minecraft, but the idea of habits, of practices, of lived practices. And in some ways, what you do in games is you defamiliarize, or you kind of weirdify ordinary habits, ordinary practices. Those might be, you know, physical, like constructing things out of little Lego blocks, or virtual, as is the case in Minecraft. But more often, I don't know if Minecraft is a great example of this, more often the thing that terrifies people about games is exactly the thing that I wonder if y'all might not be interested in, namely, how do we get into these cycles, right, where what the things that we practice, the actions that we perform are regulated or are sort of facilitated by games. You sit there on the train or in the queue at the coffee shop and you move your Candy Crush, you know, gourds and whatnot around. And the game is—it's not so much that it's programming you or that it's manipulating you. That's not what I want to suggest. But rather that you develop these habits, and the game inspires and encourages them. And that metaphor, which may or may not be right—I mean, it's certainly not as though folks are sort of worshiping at the altar of, or maybe of Minecraft, and maybe even of Candy Crush, although not in the way that they might expect. But that's the similarity, is you know, structures that are you know, somewhat unseen, sometimes ideologized, other times very much present, such that we celebrate them, that structure and cohere habits, ways of living on a moment-to-moment, day-to-day basis. I think that's the coupling point I see, but as a non-scholar of religion, between games. And it's something that the game studies folks are not interested in or don't see, because we're usually obsessed with this idea of games being entertainment forms or cultural forms that are supposedly on par with or replacing cinema or literature, which is false. But this sort of like secondary level where games are facilitating or encouraging action or thoughts or feelings or compulsions, I think that's the place where there's potentially productive interchange. All right. Okay.
Good morning. So it's wonderful to be on this panel and to follow Ian in particular. I'm going to talk about ritual as well. So rather than being prescriptive about what religious studies should do, I want to talk about two areas in particular that my research is concentrating on currently. And the first is to think about, because I work in Jewish education and Jewish studies and media studies, game studies, as well as religious studies broadly, I'm looking at how games, and I'll talk about Minecraft in particular, interweave with contemporary Jewish practice at the moment. So, for example, there are two cases that I'm looking at.
One is how a synagogue in the Midwest reached out to a student with learning differences
and found a love of Minecraft, and then was able to use that in a public setting for a bar mitzvah, which was led by this young person into Minecraft, into a world they designed. And so they discussed their Torah portion and led the congregation through his own rite of passage and a deeply moving service through Minecraft, which he designed. And that's a combination of the clergy reaching out and the teachers reaching out and the family working together. So really interweaving video game with religion. And a second one that I'm working on is a birthday party in which a young person designed a Minecraft birthday party and built their own commandments. There's 7 commandments of Minecraft. How do people get along and play together? And so drawing from the frame of this family, which is a Jewish frame, and what the 10 commandments mean, and they are active in community as well. And then how Minecraft in particular, and video games in general, allow for an interweaving of understanding and a framing of video games through a religious perspective. So that's one area that I look at. And then I spend most of my time in looking at interventions. I use a methodology, design-based research, to look at how we can improve formal and informal learning environments through games and simulations. My previous work was in augmented reality for teaching modern Jewish history, labor and women's history, immigrant history in New York, with a game called Jewish Time Jump that would feed people images and original historical artifacts from 100 years in the past based on where they stood as the largest women-led strike in American history occurred. And I've shifted now to looking at games as rule-based systems and also religious legal systems as rule-based systems. So the current project at RIT and the RIT Magic Center is looking at North Africa in the 12th century, Jewish, and eventually we'll look at Muslim religious legal codes, and how can we use game systems, strategic tabletop card systems, then moving to mobile, to explore the pro-social, what evolutionary biologists call the pro-social aspects of religion, so collaboration and cooperation. So I'm looking at affecting learning environments for the acquisition of cultural practice, and religious literacy, and eventually policy impact is the long-term goal. Thanks.
So closely connected on the panel, it's really hard to get out of that corner. So my name is Michael. I'm teaching religious education at a German university, and I'm interested in the educational aspects of computer games and religion. I did my dissertation on that, and maybe I shouldn't tell you so much what I think, how we should engage with video games when we're thinking about education and religion, but I'll just give you two case studies from that dissertation. So what I did was, and that's been years ago, I took the shooter game Unreal. Do you know that game? And I took it to religion classes in public schools. We had to get permission from the parents to do that, of course. And asked the students to construct religious spaces within the editor of that game. So basically, we did with that game Unreal, we did what people do in Minecraft nowadays. And something amazing happened. So we had this protocol that they would need to construct those spaces that they would deem religious, and then they would need to explain why they thought that was religious and what tradition that would adhere to and things like that. And there were several groups who basically built spaces that were centered on community and their community experience and their peer group and everything, and that had to do with the age range that we were addressing. And then there was this one group, and that was a fascinating example. They sort of built a traditional Catholic looking church. There was this huge crucifix with the corpus on, and then there was the baptismal and Bibles and tiled glass windows and a whole roof made of tiled glass. And they presented that to their fellow students, and in the ensuing discussion somebody said, "That's crap. Look at that glass. If just one of the guys throws a rock up there, this glass will all shatter down." So here's the rub. In that class was a non-Christian student. She was a Buddhist. And everybody was thinking about this rock, and she said, "Well, it shouldn't be a problem for you. I mean, within your religion, only he who is not a sinner should cast the first stone." It took the other students more than a quarter of an hour to get what she had said. Yeah, it says something about the quality of religious education, doesn't it? But the thing is, that is actually what I think we should be going for. These are open worlds, and you can construct everything you want, and you can question all your religious tradition, you can transform religious ritual and things. And if we're thinking about religious education and video games, I think this is the way to go. And the other, how much time do I have? 15 seconds. So the other example is from a group of students who were way younger, and when they were asked to construct religious worlds, they constructed spaces that showed an ethical, a moral way of leading your life, because if you did it wrong, you ended up in hell. But there was this trapdoor which would get you back up to heaven. And yeah, I'll leave it at that. Heaven is a good way to end this. Okay, thank you.
Hi, my name is Jason. I'm a journalist. Which is why my academic affiliation is Brooklyn. I was reporting in Bhutan over the summer about a series of really fascinating religious games, and there's something about the cities in Bhutan, these small cities. The streets don't have names, but the intersections do, and that's sort of been my approach here, that games and religion intersect in a lot of places, and maybe we don't know the street names yet, but there are some of these intersections that are very familiar. So my work has been in sort of trying to put a name to some of these major intersections. And I just wanted to sort of run down them very quickly with Minecraft in blue screen. Minecraft as an example of what those might be. And the first one of these intersections is this sort of didactic intersection where games sort of teach religious ideas. And I think we see it through Bible games and things like that. We see that's certainly a way that they can be used. And this is a long history in sort of Sunday school games. The second I call the hesiastic games, sort of games that are part of a religious event, like Ramadan games or Agena games in Ethiopia. And you find this with Minecraft maybe a little bit at Minecon, these sort of like, or maybe at this sort of bar mitzvah example, where sort of like games are part of religious events that sort of like lend color and spice. Next two categories maybe don't have a lot to do with Minecraft. I call them the poimenic category. This is sort of divination games. Lots of our games that we know nowadays come from divination traditions. And I think Minecraft probably doesn't have any of that going on with it that I know of, goodness knows. And then this praxic categories looks at games that are traditionally used as means of meditation or practice in themselves. I think of the Zen koan in a way. If you can look at the koan as a riddle game, this is a very interesting way that games are sort of used as a focus. Go in ancient Taoism, you sort of see this as a sort of a way that ideas are sort of, you know, lived and practiced. The game itself is the focus. The ancient Olympics, maybe another example of this. You don't see that so much in modern games, I'd say. And then the last three categories are less religion, looking at games, and more games sort of looking at religion, sort of the other side of town, the intersections on the other side of town. The first of those is this allomythic category, basically when games have an in-game religion that is not necessarily the religion of the people who practice it. And in Minecraft, you've got these temples and these priests. And I think it's interesting to analyze those. I think it's very Protestant in Minecraft because all of the temples are empty and the priests are sort of just there to sort of be very practical. You know, they trade with you. Anyways, it could be interesting. And I think Skyrim and lots of narrative games have in-game religions that are maybe an interesting way to sort of look at these. The allopolitical, basically when the game creates a polis, it creates a space for people to bring their religions that they experience out of the world into the game space, and that's sort of in-game cathedrals and people playing Ramadan playthroughs of Minecraft where they don't eat pork and they might pray five times a day in the sort of direction of the in-game sun. And the last one is the theoptic for God games, which is... You can look at Minecraft as a game-making space, as a sort of a God game, but it would be, and I think all of those bring their own kind of methodological approaches, but again, it's maybe a way to start setting up these questions. Thanks.
So now we're going to have a response from Michael Hausman over the what he heard from the presenters on this question.
Okay. First of all, my apologies because, in fact, I based my remarks on the things I read, and some of them go beyond what was actually said here, but hopefully there'll be some relevance. And I want to thank the organizers because my role is, as someone from the outside, is to raise kind of general issues and pose difficult-to-answer questions. Now, this could be fun, right? So I'm going to try and do that very briefly. My involvement in video gaming is minimal. It amounts to an embarrassingly short time in Second Life. You know, just too difficult, so I've dropped out. So I want to begin by just stating the idea that video gaming and religion, if it's worthwhile, I think Greg says this at one point in what he wrote, reveals something of what it is to be human. And the specificities of what it reveals, I think, are linked to the way it conceives of the three poles that constitute this this area of study, so game, digital media, and religion. And I'm going to talk briefly about those three. I'm going to say very little about digital media, a little bit about religion, but I'd like to say a bit about game, okay? And the idea is to elicit kind of reactions to this and to begin discussion in general. One of the things that comes out, and it came out in what people were saying here, is the idea of game is rule governed, and this was underlined by Owen and speaking of laws and by Ian. In that way, it's kind of like religion, and specifically like ritual, in which there's a patterned behavior that's imposed in part from without. And in the same way, it's kind of different from mundane life in that game is presumed to provide a kind of a controlled environment, a slightly kind of simplified, more predictable, where certainty is more present. And in that way, and there's an idea that many of us can have, is that gaming provides a kind of a refuge, a source of comfort in a world, and I'm citing Rachel here, that's, you know, could be seen as spinning out of control, in which uncertainty is the norm, and within gaming there's a certain amount of certainty. Well, I'd like to say you could turn this around, and this actually links up to something that Ian was saying before. Maybe games can be seen as providing exemplary experiences of uncertainty. These are simplified worlds, but worlds in which uncertainty is made explicitly present and something that one has to actually deal with. As Jason said at one point, maybe it's games are the art form of uncertainty, like religion might be the technology of uncertainty. I mean, this is actually places uncertainty in the middle of one's focus. And the type of uncertainty, in particular, one's involved with are other people, other agents. Watch out. And this is either the ambiguities of collective allies, you never really know, and then there's all individual enemies. So there is a kind of an idea of the game that kind of teaches us and provides us with experiences that are personally lived through and that are kind of touchstones for what life is about. And one of the lessons is it's uncertain. And that, you can actively choose and you can learn and you can construct, but basically it's uncertain, and this uncertainty is about survival, one, and the ones one has to be uncertain about are other people. So that was just the first point, that this idea that in fact games might express certain things, but they might actually format them. Okay. The second idea was rule-bound. Okay, there are rules, but the whole point of games is that it's not just rules, because if you play just following the rules, this is no fun at all, and you drop the game immediately. Games have to be fun. They have to be enjoyable. And that is, you don't need to only play, you have to play well for a game to be really game. And that's what's really interesting. I mean, in ritual, if you don't do the ritual properly, you didn't do the ritual, period. That's it. It's yes or no. In game, it doesn't work that way. It's more or less. I can play badly, but I'm not playing any less, right? So a good, well played game is more game than a badly played game. And this is because the game is really weird. Because on the one point, your actions are supposed to conform to certain norms that are not, not your own. Your actions are not just expressive of what you're feeling and thinking, but they reflect these certain norms, like rules that are imposed. But at the same time, you've got to get involved personally, be involved. And so, in fact, it is an expression of your personal thoughts and feelings, all the while it shouldn't be. And there's this kind of juggling act when you're playing games, a kind of balancing act that accounts for these weird figures that only exist in play situations. Cheaters, spoiled sports, referees, it doesn't exist anywhere, notably not in ritual, because it's a complicated thing, and I think play is much more complicated than ritual in that respect. Okay. Now, the third thing is, what are these rules in games? Okay, basically these are conventions that are recognized as different from the conventions that often go without saying of everyday interaction. And these conventions can either apply to the world in which you move in, the frame. This is a world in which you can only go to that place. You can only touch the ball with your feet or whatever. And that usually gives a game. Or these conventions, these out of the ordinary conventions, apply to the actors in the world. And that's usually a situation of play, of pretend play. And, I'm the pony, you're the princess. So what we're going towards here is an idea of maybe gameplay. For me, there's not really much different other than the fact that in game, since the conventions apply to not the agents, they can be distanced and therefore, in principle, can be made explicit as rules, whereas in play, this is much more difficult. It's just like ordinary life, except for one thing. The conventions one obeys are recognized as conventions different from the ones one uses in your ordinary life. And what that means is, I mean, once again, it's not a matter of just obeying certain rules. You've got to actually get into it, you know, and want to win or want to make it beautiful or whatever. And what that means is that gaming and playing games is highly reflexive. You have to be aware of both the specialness of the rules you're using and the fact that they are special with respect to these other rules that you're not using. And also the other consequence is there's a great lability. You can go back and forth from gaming and mundane life very easily. Huh? You can switch and see things from the gaming side. Actually, what is ordinary life? It's like a big game, right? Just a bunch of conventions. It's actually the only real difference. You know, and this is all, you know, the typical thing is Gregory Bates and a personal hero of mine, you know, you're playing with a dog, you know, you throw the stick or the ball, you don't know, you throw the stick, the dog comes back, you just throw, yeah, stop it! No, how do you actually, you know, indicate that you're playing or not playing? It's very kind of, you know, difficult. And gaming, of course, in games, there is the pretense of this kind of framework, but there is this ability. Now, these two features, both reflexivity and lability, seem to be favored by certain, I discovered this word recently, love it, affordances of digital media. That is, the digital media has this kind of, it favors a certain awareness that one is acting in a world of one's own creation. There's this kind of split consciousness. You know, the idea of playing, of getting into digital media, playing games, is not that you're totally absorbed, but there's a kind of a vibrant ambiguity between being in that world and being aware of the fact that this is a world in which one is aware of being in. You know, and that okay, this is kind of a weird kind of, it's like visualization. Right? It's not just imagination. Visualization is in my mind's eye, I see something in which I can interact with. So where am I? Two places, right? I'm the one imagining me interacting, and I'm the interactive, right? So, and that gives me a special experience. So the experience is not being lost in it; it's being kind of having this special kind of doubled consciousness. It's a lot like reading, right? You know, where I get absorbed in the characters. Except here, it's massively visual, and that's going to be my first link with religion. Monotheism has a great tradition with images, right? There's iconoclasts and iconofields, and this whole thing about representation and incarnation and the power of images to become actual actors and persons with intentionalities and things like that. Well, maybe this gaming, this media gaming participates, you know, is another further modulation of this preoccupation in monotheism of images and the power that they have. And the second thing is to do with the split consciousness. I'm really intrigued. What would the ritualization of that type of stance be like? I was very intrigued by the idea that often games of digital media games imply games within games. Now, maybe the games within games are games, but the game they're within maybe might be something that would benefit from being seen as something ritual. We live in a society in which games are just, it's imbued with games. Huh? This is television games, and then there's sports that are just all over the place, and then there's video games. In a lot of societies, daily life is imbued with what we would call ritual. So what is it to have a society in which, in place of ritual, we have games? That's our main mode of being who we are. And my question, I guess, would be, well, once again, what would the ritualization of that be like? What's the difference between a game and a ritual game? Okay, and I'll end that.
So now we have 10 minutes for panel respondents to respond to either each other or the comments they just heard from Michael. So if you want to respond, if you could raise your hand and I'll kind of point to you so we have a kind of order. So who would like to go first? Don't all jump up at once.
Yeah, we can also.
Okay. So, well, we're going to first go to questions from the audience or comments from the audience. And if you, when you stand up, if you could give your name and affiliation and speak loudly, that would be helpful. Questions?
Hi, Michael. I'm at Emory Theological Studies. You mentioned you dropped the phrase double consciousness, and I heard some other people talk about being able to transform. Double consciousness is pretty heavy laden. The boy talking about building this African American experience under this other consciousness of oppression. I was wondering if anybody could speak to maybe the potency of gaming as a way to craft a new narrative on self in the digital life that might be carried back into real life.
Yes, I don't know if you know the work of Sherry Turkle. Do you know who you're working on? And she's at MIT. She's at MIT. But basically, I should be able to talk to like 200 people. You'd think I would be able to talk to this room. So I don't want to. So Sherry Turkle, who works on this, and she's at MIT. I think she's still at MIT, but like, and so she works a lot about not so much in gaming, but in digital media about notions of identity formation. It's interesting because her early work basically counteracts her later work. I mean, they're in tension with each other. But a lot of people have worked on notions of identity in digital media, especially like the crafting of avatars. And when you're online, you're not sure that who the actual world person and the avatar, the identity you're interacting with, you don't know if they're the same people. And so there's lots and lots written on identity formation, right?
What's her last name?
Turkle?
Turkle.
Yeah, Sherry Turkle. And if you Google it, I mean, it should pop up. Yeah.
Just to add on what Greg was talking about, I also think a lot about Marcus and Nureus's work and Jim G. or James Paul G. References that work as well. So possible selves. So the aspect of role playing is, I think, very important in terms of thinking about identity. And Marcus and Nureus's work, I think, directly speaks to your point about can you imagine, what's your imagined self? And then Jim G. and other people then apply that to games to say if you're role playing and you can imagine, have an imagined self, how that may help you shift, change, or transform your identity. So both of those pieces of work will probably be helpful as well. Well, it's two, Marcus and Nureus, and then Jim G. or James Paul G. is kind of the Pied Piper of Games for Learning in the last 10, 15 years.
I'm going to add one more, and I'm just going to talk really loudly, which is not my nature. But Jane McGonigal, Reality is Broken, if you want a sort of gamer's perspective. I think she's a little bit too positive of an apologist, but she does talk about how playing games can make you braver, sort of make you sort of more aware of who you are, and let you realize skills that you didn't know that you had. And the title book, Reality is Broken, sort of beckons toward a sort of religious perspective, even though she never explicitly takes it. She says that reality is broken, but games can sort of fix reality in some kinds of way. So it's worth a read.
Other questions?
Daniel from Yale Divinity, History of Christianity. You were talking before about religions within games, but then also the category of like games mimicking certain religions and our reality. I was just curious, my own work, studying Bioshock Infinite and Mormonism, the act of comparative studies, because comparative religious studies has been around for a long time. Do you think that in valuing the study of religion and the study of video games, the fact that new games create new religions with every lots of successive titles, that that's an ongoing dialogue within the field, or are we just going to run out of options at some point?
Sure.
within the field of game design or within sort of academic study? I can't actually speak to academic study all that much, but certainly within the field of game design, this idea of playing with religion is ripe and evolving. There was at the Game Developers Conference in maybe 2011, Frank Lance sort of gave this speech, wanting games to be these instruments of cosmic consciousness. That same year, they had this sort of game design conference, which was Games Bigger Than Jesus, and Jason Rohrer invents a game that this year, I forget what it's called, but it's basically a little world that's contained on a floppy drive, and then Wired writes a big article that he's actually created a real-world religion. So I would say certainly from one side, this idea, and all of those players, Frank Lance and Jason Rohrer, are professed and vehement atheists. So, but they see within this field of game design this possibility of playing with ideas about religion as just primary to what's going on, especially in narrative games. You just find that an awful lot. I mean, certainly, I would say that there's a lot of heat in playing with big ideas in the narrative possibilities that games sort of allow. And as far as sort of what would be happening on the flip side of the sort of academic, looking at the sort of like proliferation of religious narratives within this medium, I defer to somebody else. But
I just wanted to say a word about the imagined self as being a way to change oneself. I think this also can be appreciated as a cultural idea. It's not self-evident. However, in our culture, we put great value for this possibility that imagined selves can have an effect on who I might be. And I think gaming provides a means to keep that as a viable premise for our culture.
John Blackman, Masters of Divinity at Emory University. And you had spoken about the kind of rule-based portion of the gaming experience. Could you maybe speak to like people modifying their gaming experience or transgressing the rules or expectations in order to gain an advantage, and how that might reflect on how they view the rules or regulations of culture, society, or maybe religion?
I'm thinking in particular about transgressive play. So the game that we're currently developing, the idea is, right, there are rules, but how does play emerge or emergent play from them? So are you going to follow the rules? Are you going to break the rules? What are the other players? How do they feel about that? So can you give me the end point of your question again, the very last part about when you decide how you create other sets of rules through play?
Or, how you modify your experience how that might reflect how you view the rules of society or like the expectations of your religious institution.
Yeah, I guess I think this idea of emergent play, that there are a set of rules, and then what happens during play are all of these, and I mean, I think in a good game is that play emerges, that in some ways is transgressive, is some way transformative, and the experience of play allows for a different ideas, kind of related to Erikson's psychosocial moratorium, and if I'm remembering a piece I might have read by Ian, I think, on that. That there's that space to play can allow, I think, for potential transformation through play.
I just think it's really important to take apart rules and play. I mean, they're really two different things. When you conflate them, I mean, I think you lose a lot. So, when I play games, I don't ever follow the rules. I just try to break them, right? And that's what I do. When I play Tomb Raider, I just played, and basically I don't follow the rules. I don't follow the track. I wander off into the corner and see what I can break, right? And so I think it's an important thing. But your second part of the question, I think it's really fabulous, and I don't have an answer for it, but I'm going to start thinking about it.
I did some work with Jewish a game I designed that was played sort of in New York and London and a few other places was called Shabbat Put, in which we engaged some folks from Jewish Theological Seminary. And it was basically, the goal of the game was to sort of break the rules of the game. The premise was that were traveling to play in the Olympics in ancient Greece, but it was the Sabbath, so how do you sort of participate in these events by kind of breaking and shaping and reinventing the rules? And I think if you spend time in Israel, you sort of see that there is this kind of gaming of Sabbath rules, right? The sort of Menachot. It was a really positive way to sort of engage that theological community in sort of discussions about the rules and how we live in tension with the rules and sometimes sort of like manipulate the rules. And I feel like that's one example of sort of where games are maybe one of the better places to sort of teach those lessons or sort of engage with those tensions.
Can I add to that? Am I loud enough? Because I can't get out here. So thing is, from an educational perspective, I mean, this is where I think we would need to go with games, right? Because to, as you said, you just break the rules, but to break the rules, you need to know about the rules. You don't basically need to know the rules, but you need to know about them to break them. So I would think, if from my perspective, if I'm thinking about education and gaming, or better, playing and religion, that is exactly what I would go for, and that is what I would want religious education, where I would want religious education to go, to teach about the rules and then deliberately try to bend them, break them, shift them, push the outside of the envelope to see what the actual scope of the rules were and how you apply them to, as you said, society or real life. So I wouldn't say transgression leads to delinquency, but I would say transgression leads to better understanding what you're transgressing. Okay?
Well, we'll have more time for questions as we move on, but I want to move on to the second question. So the question number two is, what methods and research questions do you recommend? And we're asking the scholars really to draw on their own experience in their work here. We're going to start with Rachel, then Zina, then Greg, and then Kristen.
Hello. There's many ways of thinking about religion and video games, as there are methods for thinking about any facet of religious studies. So choosing one method is really just a matter of each researcher deciding what you can bring to the table. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I do. Until recently, I didn't have a name for it, but Greg helped me name it, and I'm very grateful for that. If I could draw on the work of Wendy Doniger and the implied spider, I can find a name for what it is I do. This is the comparatist model. So a little bit of what she means by the title. She says we can take the spider to be the shared humanity, the shared life experience that supplies the web-building material, the raw material of narrative to countless human webmakers, authors, anthropologists, and comparatists. These storytellers gather up the strands that the spider emits to weave their own individual cultural artifacts. They function like Venn diagram webs of shared themes. And that's what I do. Basically, that means that I don't come up with a research question. I come up with a topic or a theme that interests me. Right now I'm interested in apocalypticism. And then I go read as widely as possible, get as many voices as possible, and see what connections occur. And that leads me to more questions and helps me do a sort of cultural studies kind of analysis. Actually I could probably stop right there. But so my conversation partners would include gamer studies, media studies, various forms of communication studies. So with Minecraft, for example, I'm really interested in the cultural relevance of the game beyond the game context. So I'm not just interested in what happens inside the game. I think other people share that interest. So I'm interested in Comic-Cons, blogs, YouTube shows, educational uses, religious practices, costumes, bedding, blocks, action figures, Lego sets, toy weapons, clothing. There's even creeps now that are sort of Minecraft's answer to peeps. There are videos made by Stampy Cat. If you have kids, you've heard of Stampy Cat. And you don't have to have played Minecraft in order to know something or be interested in Stampy Cat. I'm also interested in the symbolic role of the pixel. So I'm interested in sort of the way that Minecraft may represent a sort of metaphor for a new view of reality that we now have, that it's buildable, thinking about sort of 3D printing, right, and construction. And now we're sort of beginning to view our reality in a very, very different kind of way. So again, I'm sort of interested in games as part of a much larger cultural conversation. Now, I will say that one danger of the comparative study is that you have to be really careful, you have to be really invested, you have to read very deeply, and you have to be fully interdisciplinary. So one of the dangers is to be sort of shallow and sort of read a little bit of this and a little bit of that and not be able to sort of deeply engage with these other fields. So you have to be fully committed if you're going to do this, or you'll have shallow research. And I'll also just add that Wendy Doniger says that the spider is not only implied, the spider is real, because we're looking at real cultural products out there. Right? And so it's only implied because there's not just one spider there. We're all participating in constructing this web and also in analyzing it. So that's my approach.
Thank you.
I'm Xenia. I'm working on the intersection of media, including video games and gaming, and religion in Asia, and particularly in India. I do have a thesis or remarks. I've been reflecting on the research question in this question number two. That is, what research questions would you recommend? Of course, it is difficult, if not presumptuous, to recommend research questions for a whole discipline or a sub-discipline. That goes without saying. I do understand, though, the need and also the advantage of critically reflecting and discussing research questions which would benefit the organized sort of development of our new academic subfield, which is gaming and religion, which would then, in the best case scenario, also contribute to rethink approaches and key perspectives in the whole discipline, that is religious studies itself. And of course, that means obviously encouraging a wide array of research questions. But this said, I also want to stress that personally, I would love to encourage certain questions, questions which I feel are still underrepresented. I've argued elsewhere before that gaming is highly global. I think we all agree on that. And it is important, though, not to mistake this argument as meaning to say that gaming, in whatsoever way, is uniform or standardized across the globe. Gaming as a global phenomenon does not mean that, for example, people in the USA, in Europe, or, for instance, in India, play the same or even just similar games, have access to the same or even just similar technical facilities, produce the same or even similar kind of games, or interpret the narrative in a similar way. Rather, the information I get from my research fieldwork and from my experiences on games and gaming in the USA, in Europe, and in India, all these experiences point at massive differences, in fact, in all these and in more points. I actually flew into Atlanta directly from India, and never before I was so aware of how diverse gaming landscapes worldwide are. In the case of India, for example, any research would need to take at least two major game settings in society, existing in society, into account. While also in India, we have a certain number of mostly young people from affluent levels of society, from the upper middle class and the upper class itself in urban environments. We also, and these people have access, of course, to everything that is Western standard, so to say, and they play the AAA games, which are also globally distributed. But we also have a much higher number of people not having access to these. And I think it is very, very important. This is an example from India, but I think it's exemplary in some way for the gaming worldwide. We would need to really tackle such questions as well.
If you're wondering what game we're playing, I think it's Twister. So my name is Gregory Price Grieve. If you Google me, I'm not the dead chiropractor. I'm the other one. And again, if you want to, you know, after this, if you want to email me and contact me and get some, I can feed you to the right people. So feel if you're interested in anything that's happening here, just contact me and I'll put you in contact with them. I wanted to thank Michael, who's not a gamer, and we basically brought him in because, to do this. And I also want to thank Ian so much for coming. It was great. And then Heidi's the co-editor on Let's Play. What is it? Not Let's Play. Playing with Religion in Digital Games. So she didn't mention that, but she is. And then finally, Kirsten and Zena are going to publish all of this up afterwards. So if you're missing something, you're not taking notes fast enough, it will be published on their journal. Again, I was thinking about my methodology is what I would call a documentary style methodology. It actually comes from my field work making documentary films, and basically a documentary style. It's similar to what Rachel was talking about, which is that I have some topic, like I want to study religion in Minecraft. And then it's a qualitative method where I would then just go and play the game, collect everything I can find, collect everything as much as I can, right? So there's no hypothesis, really. I'm not trying to go into the game to prove something. I'm basically just going into the game to explore and to collect and to see what's there. I'm not looking for what I don't know. I'm looking for what I don't know I don't know, right? And that's, for me, it's kind of this arena of discovery. And if I do this right, when I'm done, it's an Irish wall. There's no real theory at the end. It's just the different pieces all kind of fit together. I'm picking up the rocks and putting. Does that make sense? I don't know if anyone's ever seen an Irish wall, but that's how I always think about it. It's similar to, I would say, new game journalism. It's similar to Let's Play videos, if you watch those. And it's also similar to autoethnography, if anyone's read in that field. So all those kind of play into the background of what I'm doing. It differs, however, because I'm really interested in thick description coming from Gertz, which is not just the describing what you see, but describing it in a context that an outsider can understand what that thing means. Does that make sense? I'm thinking about Steve's pickaxe, right? It's not just describing, this is the little character in Minecraft, it's not just describing Steve's pickaxe, but it's describing what that pickaxe means to a player, what that pickaxe means to the community of players, what that pickaxe means maybe in consumptive practices. So it's not just merely a description, but it's a description within the cultural context with which that practice takes place.
Okay, thank you. My name is Kerstin Rade-Antweiler, which is a really, really hard name for Americans to pronounce in the right way, so I'm sorry for that. I will focus on my little speech on the first part of the question, what kind of methods we have to use. And I will start with the point, why methods at all, because I think there's nothing really special about researching video gaming and religion or video gaming and ritual, because in every research field you have to reflect on methods you're using, and I think this is really, really crucial, because in some of the researches, in recent research, we have to, we just have to observe that there is a kind of lack of methods, and it's crucial because otherwise we can't understand the argumentation, why the people are coming to this argument or to the other argument. And then now I'll give some examples for what kind of methods I would recommend. I mean, they're totally dependent on the research question I have, but in general I'm coming from a sociological perspective, and for me I'm interested in the actor in his gametized world, so to speak. It's derived from a term by Friedrich Krotz, the mediatized life worlds we're all living in, and I would say we're now in a gametized life worlds we're living in, because you have your handy, where your smartphone, where you play Candy Crush, for example, or you're all playing games in different modes, not only video gaming, but other games as well. So I would distinguish in the with the actor, concerning the actor in video gaming, such as the games designer, the game itself, and of course the gamer. And on all three levels, we have to reflect on the culture and technical environment. And we developed, or we're in the beginning of development, a concept like game environments, where we distinguish these kind of different fields, and to really look what kind of research question, on which level we have, and what is concerning. For example, Xenia mentioned the culture environment. It's totally different for Indian gamers or for Indian games designers, such as games designers in the US or also in Germany. And I think there's what we also differences between them. And of course, the methods you're using are totally dependent on this perspective, on this level you have to make research. And I would broaden the whole thing, not on games, but on video gaming, on the process of actor playing these games. And I'm interested in the ascription of meaning. So is it a play? Is it a game? Is it a religion? Is it a ritual? I mean, this were the question raised by Michael. And coming to the example, because I really love Bioshock Infinite, it was really interesting for me, because coming from a more media studies and having a more literature point of view in my beginning of the research, I love the baptism scene because it's so full of religion. And then coming from the sociological point of view and really making research on the gamer, most of them, yeah, they recognize it. It's a kind of baptism, but it's no meaning at all ascribed to this scene. There are totally other parts would be, especially also the rules and we just mentioned. I mean, are the rules really so important as we would suggest, and of course also religious symbols? And I will start. And
I'd like to now invite Michael to give a second response to the questions and comments.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, so methods are really important. Yeah? that's one big message. The other thing is that your methods reflect the way you conceive of your object, basically. And and it seems to me that there are two large kind of families of methods that are work here. The one is where you identify and you circumscribe a category of phenomena. And then you try and figure out how that thing works and what are the principles that organize it and stuff like that. And this is very much in the spirit of what Greg called the documentary approach, which, you know, you could think of it also as clinical approach or ethnographic approach, basically. There are a number of implicit choices that one does in this approach, however. One is you distinguish something called game from the stuff that's not the game. Right? And so you have these two things, in fact, implicitly. And then you very often wonder about, well, what's the relationship between these two things? They could be, and I'm using Jason's vocabulary here, it could be didactic. You know, how does what happens in the game end up affecting what happens in the not game? Or it could be allopolitical. How what you do in your, you know, the not game end up being expressed within the game medium, or something like that. And then it also gets a little difficult exactly what are these entities you've kind of isolated. There's game, but what is not game? Is it religion? Is it like mundane life? Is it ritual? You know, what are you going to oppose? So these are choices, I think, that are important. And people make different choices, but this depends on how you conceive of your object. There is another possibility, which is the one that Kirsten seems to be pushing with words like game environment or gamatized life world, which is you don't actually have two things. You have one thing in another one. And therefore, when you try and do this back and forth thing, it's a little more difficult because you don't have two well-circumscribed worlds. In fact, you have one that's the game and the other one is everything else. And therefore, and you can't do it all. And I think that's maybe one of the reasons why Kirsten feels the need to hammer the idea that we've got to problematize it, because you can't actually do an ethnography of everything. Okay? And so there's this idea of you've got to kind of limit it a little bit. It gets complicated, and I think this is one of the things that Zinyas pointed out, is that there is no kind of standardization of this, neither of the experience of the game or of the everything else's. That is, that this is, there's a great deal of cultural variability that just means that the everything else is not only are the games rather different from one place to another, but the everything else's are rather different from one place to another. So the systematic relationships you want to draw between these things, one has to be sensitive to the fact that there is a great deal of a variation. I think the danger with this is kind of falling in love with your discriminations, with your categories. And that you forget, and this is something that Greg has really stressed, you forget these are conceptual constructs. These are models. That is, you know, so they're cheap. You know, you can change them every week. It's not a big deal, you know. But one tends to forget that, and then you kind of get married to certain conceptions that you then think that your models are more real than the phenomena they're supposed to be. So that's one big option, and you see it's got these problems in it. The other option is you just throw out categories altogether, right? And you just start spinning or knitting or, you know, and you just kind of wander around. You take a theme and you just go for it, you know? This is a spider thing, right? And it's sort of the comparative thing. for me, this is very much like structuralism without the structure. It's just kind of like, you know, keep going. And basically, things hook onto each other and they become interesting insofar as they seem to be relevant to the theme that you're going on about. Now, I think the danger here for me is spiders only produce thread, nothing else, right? And so there's a tendency to conceive of these links as homogeneous and as linking homogeneous areas. It's no accident that this whole procedure, like structuralism, was invented for myth, that is, stuff that's fairly homogeneous as a type of discourse. Okay? But if you begin linking things that are less homogeneous, like ways of behaving, ways of talking about one's behavior, ways of thinking, of feeling, of singing, or building, or making, cooking, or whatever, you know, then there's a little trap, which is either one tends to favor the connectedness, and that usually entails homogeneizing these different objects, or you keep the fact that these objects are really rather different types of realities, and then the connections between them become slightly more contingent than one would necessarily like. But once again, the advantage of this is that you can make these connections that you can't necessarily make when you're into subscribing a particular world like that. Now, Dan Sperber, a cognitive anthropologist, raised very early on the one of the dilemmas of social science, and I think applies also to the study of religion, which is there seem to be two ways of modeling things, and we're just stuck in them, and we've got to get beyond that. One is you model things with, these are categorical models. Basically, you cut up life into things, right? And then you ask about the relationship between these. So this gives you kind of classificatory schemes. And the other one are network models, basically, where this is about circulation and things, you know, go around and things like that. These, both of these, as I tried to show, have kind of certain disadvantages. His idea was, we've got to get beyond this. We've got to have some type of analytical construct that provides us with something halfway between, or that transcends this distinction between categories and networks, modes of circulation and modes of being. And I wonder whether, and that's pretty much my question, I wonder whether the affordances, once more, Stuart Hoover, of digital media, and of gaming in digital media, and of ritualized gaming in digital media, might provide grounds for the development of new types of analytical models that has this betweenness, once again, Stuart Hoover, I went to his talk the other day, between categories and networks. And this whole thing about this reflexivity as being constitutive of the gaming experience, and at the same time, this experience is supposed to have an effect on one's life in general, which is exactly what rituals are supposed to do, such that, once again, I suspect that ritualized gaming, the ones that are actually has an effect on one's life, have rather different special properties. I'm just wondering whether that whole field can't provide the grounds for other types of models that gets away from this choice between categories and networks.
So we have some time for more questions and responses from the audience.
Absolutely critical to that.
the interesting thing about the baptism scene is, or was for me, the going beyond just in big quotation marks, analyzing the narrative of a game, because from what I experienced from also from my second life in World of Warcraft and research was really the thing that a lot of gamers are just clicking the quest, but they're not interested in the narrative at all. I mean, of course, here we have to ask, how can we research a kind of influence? Because, of course, they are confronted with this baptism scene, and how can we deal with this? And for me, it was interesting to take the baptism scene also in a visual discourse analysis, because you can additionally ask what is, in a Foucault sense, what is showable or speakable in society nowadays, and how is this changing, and is it more speakable or showable in a video gaming, a kind of baptism scene, but connected, for example, with the whole bundle of civil religion within the game. So for me, the thing was really to go beyond, but not totally skip the narrative, the analysis of the narrative approach. Yes.
And again, this is me talking to gamers, you know, basically talking to gamers. So Vit Sisler, who's a Czech, does the Czech scholar, who has a piece in IDMI edited volume, he divides a video game into audiovisual, narrative, and at the procedural level, right? And so when I was talking to gamers about that baptism scene, what they found wrong with it was that it was totally trapped. You had no choice in what you did. And for them, that was, they did not like that, right? That they saw that as kind of just a bad game design. Mm-hmm. So their whole point was just to get through it. How can I get through this as quickly as possible? Mm-hmm. It seemed that for most of the gamers, what became meaningful were the choices that they made. So the audio-visual level and the narrative level may not, you know, there's certain things which become more important because of that procedural level. That's what I found, just kind of communicating with the gamers about it.
Can I just a short one, another example, Jedi Knight, Mysteries of the Sith from the 1990s, so that's an old game, but the it has a structural element where you experience sort of violence in the game, and it's a backstory, the video story that's told that tells the opposite, and the video story is not as powerful as what you experience in the game. Only in one of the later add-ons to that game do they actually include the video story within the interaction part, and then it becomes powerful. So that's exactly what Greg just said. It needs to be experienced, and you can't experience it in a scripted scene, right?
What game was that again?
Jedi Knight, Mysteries of the Sith.
I really appreciated you separating the game itself and the game design. Something I'm finding intriguing about my research in Bioshock Infinite. It's like, no, the game is not anti-religious, we make no statement about Christianity, and yet, the game kind of makes a lot of statements about Christianity, so, in your own, like, not to get dragged down into, like, authorial intent and modernism, in your own methodology, and this could be to anybody, how do you deal with the, like, authorial intent of, like, the game design with almost any game, and how scholars of religion, because something I found really intriguing is, in interviews, the designers actually said any criticism of Christianity or religion in this game is people reading it into that's not, and it's like, really? Like, okay.
Mm-hmm. I guess, and again, for me, I don't privilege one perspective, no, I basically bring them all together and have them in dialogue with each other. And I'm much more interested in what the gamers are doing with it than what the game designers intended, right? But I still bring that in, and I think it's when you compare those different things, I think that's when it gets interesting, right? It's when you get that thick soup of different levels. The question would be, well, why would they say that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, and that would be what I would start asking. And you know, they're saying that because they don't want to get in trouble. Mm-hmm. You know, but yeah.
Should I? Yep. Probably a little bit linked with the question, because I'm interested also in both or three levels. And I think this is a kind of a question for methods, because I'm dealing a lot with interviews and episodic interviews, because here you can distinguish between the reflexive level, and of course, it's also the thing of power relation and how you advertise the game, how you be scandally, because then it sells much more better if you have sex or power or violence and a little bit religious scandals. But also, I would be interested as well in the gamer scene to really how they, in a narrative, construction, listen way, how they construct and how they combine it with their own experience and their own, of course, views on religion.
Just so people don't know what the word affordance is. So affordance is a word that comes from design, and an affordance is something built into design that basically channels your actions with it. So like a doorknob affords the opening of the door. You can open it in other ways. And so within media studies, there's this notion that different media afford how you interact with it, right? So it would be very hard to have smell be a part of a film, right? You know, it doesn't afford it. So I mean to say, it's an excellent. I've never thought about that. I don't know if you've ever thought about
that. That's my. So I work in design. I work in design-based research, and so we specifically take an artifact out into the field with players, and we do interviews, and we do hanging out, and we do video, and we get the logs that they're from what they're playing, and then we do pre and post survey, and right to see how we can make design changes and think about how we can fix affordances or enhance them, and then we do iterative cycles of design. So that comes out of the learning sciences, where we've heard much more about affordances in the last, I'd say, 20, 30 years, but now it's working in here. So I'd be happy to talk to you more about that. So what's the question?
To just sort of reflect back on the question about BioShock, right? And I think the designers may not, you know, be thinking explicitly about what they're doing, you know, and they may not be reflecting on what it might mean to intentionally.
Right. It may not be intentional, but they're certainly not going to admit it either way, because as Greg was saying, they're just going to get themselves in trouble.
So I'm a little more skeptical. I think it's more capitalist.
Well, it's interesting too that if you look at how the translation of games from different cultures. So, like when Zelda gets translated into America, they get rid of all the Christian, and like the Bible becomes the Book of Magic.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if in a Japanese game, it's totally different, because in Japan, Christianity is kind of this almost evil foreign religion. You know, it's got, you know, and you see this in the Silent Hill games too, where Christianity. I don't know if you played Silent Hill.
They do it in Castlevania as well.
Yeah, you know, so Christianity becomes this evil other, right?
Yeah.
And so, but then when you translate that game into the North American environment, you've got to change all that. So it's interesting to see how the games translate, especially, you know, Japanese games I just love, because when they translate in. Where else can we have, like, Jesus fighting? Who's Jesus fighting? Like, Santa Claus. Right? which plays totally differently in Japan than it does here.
That sounds even
And game texts themselves are problematic. Because, I mean, look at Mass Effect. Was released finally, like, past the playtesting stage, where there is a lot of back and forth. And then folks didn't like the ending, so then they sort of, like, point-released another ending. So what is the text? So what are you going to study? I think, again, that sort of comes back to this idea that games are this kind of art form of uncertainty. There's sort of existing in a sort of hyperborean state when you talk about them, and they won't know when they sort of come into existence until they're played and sort of trigger, sort of trigger something, which I think makes them really interesting for somebody, because the player becomes just intrinsic to the study of the game, which, of course, is Christian, right? And sort of less played. Maybe the best way to study these games is less hyperborean.
other questions or comments? Wendy Doniger talks about the fox and the hedgehog, and she cites a line from the Greek poet Archilochus to describe the relationship between these two types of scholars. She says the fox knows many things, and the hedgehog knows one big thing. So comparatists are foxes, and contextualists are hedgehogs. This is one way of thinking about this relationship between the ethnographer and the comparatist, because comparatist who does her job well will be reading what everyone else is doing and not be sort of isolated in a corner. Right, so it should be reading what the ethnographers and the documentarians and so forth are doing. So should hopefully move up to that sort of larger level that you were describing.
You laid out that dichotomy between the network and I feel like I'm like somewhere in between, and so for me it's like the interesting. I would call it post-Jay-Z Smithian, which is, if such a thing exists. But, you know, like, so he has this notion of religion as solely being the category of the scholar, right? That's his, so what I used to go in, I have some notion of what religion is, let's say, but then by interacting with people, my category changes. And so the study I was just working on, I realized that there was a huge differentiation between how I was using religion and the people who I was talking to were using religion, even though we're using the same word. For me, religion was, you know, had some kind of notion to do with ultimate reality and ritual. But for them, religion was everything bad about spirituality, right? So everything that was bad about spirituality, about religion, got stuck into the religion category, and everything good went into the spiritual category, right? And, you know, and so for me, I had to change. Within the study, I had to change how I was using. So there's this dialexis. So it's not just a dialogue on at the level of content, but it's actually a dialogue on the level of the categories which you're framing that content with. And that's, you know, that underlies. I'm not sure if that's method or theory, but that's kind of underlies what I do. So
we have time for one more question or comment.
Yeah, John Borchert, Syracuse University. I'm thinking about these sort of. Right, what Greg was just talking about, what Carlson brought up, the ideas of categories versus network thinking or something like that, right? Sort of a definitional versus a relational approach when looking at digital media, specifically gaming. And I'm wondering if the primary question here is when we're thinking about how religious actors or people's interact with digital technology through gaming, is the primary question here, is this an ontologically or epistemologically based question? Right? Are we talking about a way of being in a space, or are we talking about a mode through which we know or learn something? Right? There's a lot of talk about learning, procedural learning, right? But are we thinking about, right, and I think those two, that sort of what maybe be, what might be sort of a artificial but not arbitrary distinction between sort of a category versus a network way of thinking, are embedded in those sort of distinctions, an ontological and epistemological problem, or is one favoring one more than the other? I think a sort of categorical or definitional thinking sort of models and an epistemological way of thinking about how we can think through these things, while a network model might be more relational or ontological. So I wonder if looking back at sort of ways that people have thought about embodied modes of interacting with technology prior to a gaming model, this way then enter into sort of a theoretically embedded way of thinking about this stuff without sort of eliminating the new possibilities that these allowances involve. I don't know if that's more of a question. I don't know if you got it. Right.
We can talk about this later because it would take a while to explain. But so for me, what it basically going from Merleau-Ponty through Bourdieu, I talk about media practices rather than epistemology. You know, so I don't talk about. That's what I talk about. You know, I talk about media practices. And media practices, I'm trying, you know, that kind of with that Bourdieuian notion of trying to get rid of the subject and the object.
Sure, right.
And I can talk to you more about that.
Yeah.
It would take a long time to flush out.
Yeah, right.
I don't know if this is what I'm saying.
And Mary Flanagan's done some interesting writing on embodied and the questions of epistemology and ontology in one of her Reload books, I think.
Okay.
What's the name again?
Mary Flanagan at Dartmouth.
Before we move on to question three, I've asked Ian if he would get some comments just from his overview of the study of game studies, the current trends that relate to research methods, and maybe things that we in religious studies could learn from that we haven't spoken of here.
So game studies is this field that doesn't really exist, but we pretend it does. There's a few hundred of us kind of around the world, and we have created the impression that we're a discipline, which is, you know, good on us, well done. What that means is we're very susceptible to trends. And we don't even know that they're trends because there are so few of us that it's hard to even call them trends. But if I think back 15 years sort of to the start of the establishment of a discipline like film studies or like literary studies, but for games, which we could talk separately about whether that was a good idea or not, but it happened to some extent, and without giving you this sort of long history, there was always this anxiety about colonization and independence. You know, is this, we need a study of games because otherwise the literary or film or communication or what have you, name your enemy, you know, or name the discipline in which you were intellectually reared such that you can then reject it as insufficient. So these anxieties of influence and of upbringing were very common. But where that's left us today is we kind of go through these cycles, and the current cycle is one in which social scientific methods are predominant. And I pause because, and I'm not a social scientist, and so I hope no one's recording this. I mean, I'm not really sure what any social science as applied to games, I don't know if it qualifies as social science. I'm not even sure if any social science qualifies as social science. But anyhow, the sort of very heavily ethnographic, or, you know, sort of so-called ethnographic, right? I watched someone play a game one night, and then I took it as kind of, you know, evidentiary, right? Or I talked to a bunch of people about their practices. The things with Let's Plays and Minecraft, these are great examples of the inroads that social scientific or ethnographic. I don't have anything against these methods, but this is the state that we're in, which means that sort of deep hermeneutic reading, you know, which has a relationship to many disciplines, among them religious studies, have been very much downplayed. We sort of take what people do with games as the most important thing, and whatever they do, this is going to be related to my feelings on the next question. Whatever they do is sort of fine, right? Because they're doing it, and so we just sort of, well, look at the people playing. Look at esports, you know, competitive games. This is great, it's amazing. Like all this stuff. Look at Twitch, where people are streaming themselves playing games, and then other people are streaming like these weird machines that you interact with that play the games on your behalf. So it is totally crazy and insane. But the kind of current practice is very, very, very deeply. Do you agree with this, Owen? Am I?
I'm curious where you're headed.
Curious where I'm headed too. I think what this means is that really this is very much related to my feelings on kind of the do you have to play a game to study it business. We desperately need nonconformist perspectives. There's such a, in game studies, that is, any kind of perspective that just kind of takes these games and does something with them, you know, like outside, peripherally, that doesn't really care about what I think about, you know, the treatment of that object or that medium, because it's not like there's some need to pledge fealty to game studies in order to do this kind of work, right? I mean, if you wanted to study the representation of religion in literature or film, you wouldn't sort of go to the film folks and be like, you know, what are the proper methodologies for studying film in order that we can, you know, appropriately conduct the work of religious study. So I would even, you know, go so far as to say that contrarian or aggressively contradictory methodologies or interpretations of the work that's done in media studies, generally speaking, of which, you know, I would sort of put game studies in that bag. Those would be welcome from my perspective. So this Bioshock Infinite business is obviously nonsense. You know, like what is really happening is something that requires a certain amount of indictment that in some ways cannot happen even within the domain of academic game studies, where I'm kind of giving away all my material for later. within the domain of even though there's a certain critical manifold, right, that is not like the fan or the player, the enthusiast, that there's still a sense that the givenness of the work is supposed to be taken as at face value. We're a bit too much in love with it, and so you know, to question that particular example from the perspective of expertise, of real expertise and deep knowledge and disciplinary and communal commitment to something that sort of intersects with a game like that, but and only in a very minor way, and goes back off into its own domain. These are the things that I would personally welcome more than affiliation. It's almost like there's an opportunity for a contrarian or even oppositional engagement with the methodologies of game studies, which I think are slowly winnowing out, you know, the participants who maybe even once felt very much in the fold and then realized, okay, actually this was sort of an overstep to do this isolationist maneuver in the late 90s, where we were going to found a whole discipline. And then the 2000s turned out to be a terrible decade to found a discipline at all. And after 2008, there was sort of, you know, material and economic rationales why the growth of a new discipline rather than, you know, attaching to an existing one with a tradition was not doomed to failure exactly, but suppressed growth. All right. I mean, I don't know if that's a useful. I don't know if it's useful to you to hear these reflections. But you know, what I'm telegraphing, maybe not even telegraphing, but just saying, is that I have a certain amount of dissatisfaction with not necessarily with specific methodologies, but with the seriousness with which we're taking these objects within the domain in which we're supposedly taking them very seriously. And I wonder if the answer to that is actually a kind of divestment, you know, or a diaspora. Back into specific disciplines with just more longitudinal trajectory.
Thank you, Ian. I think that's a good transition to our final question. So our final question is, do scholars have to play the game to analyze it? So each other panel respondents will have 3 minutes. We'll start with Rachel this side and work our way this way. And Ian, when we come to you, if you want to add some more comments, you can, or you can pass.
All right. So my ultimate answer is no, you do not have to play a game to analyze it, although you may think I'm shifting the question a little bit when I tell you why. I don't think you must necessarily play a game to analyze its cultural impact. So, and I've already talked about some of the ways that we can think about a sort of larger context in which we can put games. So you have children who never play Minecraft or watch Stampy the Cat. That doesn't mean that we can't study it, right? And you can have fandoms that actually don't involve playing the game at all. So we can also, along these lines, so we can draw on Doniger again, and we can talk about microscopic analysis and telescopic analysis, sort of thinking about the fox and the hedgehog again. The microscopic analysis consists of detailed analysis of individual games, case studies, walkthroughs, sort of social sciences-based consideration. And those kinds of studies, I think, would be more likely to require actual playing of the game, but the telescopic analysis might not. It's going to take in a much broader scope. As I've already said, Minecraft is not just a game, it's also a set of symbols, it's a community, it's an environment, and perhaps even a cultural language. And I want to give you sort of an example about why I think this is the case. I'm just going to say a little bit about what I'm working on now. I'm interested in new myths of apocalypticism. And see Daniel back there, I've already told him what I'm interested in working on. And if you think about apocalypticism as sort of a new myth that's sort of blossoming in America right now, we can look at all the different delivery methods by which that apocalyptic story is being told. And that's going to include video games, but it's also going to include things like the NRA. It's going to include preppers. It's going to include the gamification of life, right? And so video games are going to be only one piece of that. And I can't play every apocalyptic video game there is anyway, nor do I want to. But certainly games can be part of that larger conversation. So I think we limit ourselves. There's a way in which we make games sometimes too central if we're looking at their impact on society at large. So I'm interested in that sort of larger storytelling piece and the way that games slot in. So I think there are plenty of circumstances in which actually playing the game is not required.
I would also say no, you don't need to play the games. I guess the way that I enter into this is looking at the history of games and looking at Goethe's and the Balinese cockfights, which had a religious element. I don't think he sort of needed to be down there in the pit, looking at especially historical games like dicing in Vedic ritual, which plays this central role in narratives and actually in practice. Ashmaveda, there's a sort of game-like elements, and of course you can't play these games, and so do we invalidate this idea that you need to play games to sort of like contextualize them? That said, a spiritual text influential in my life is Zorba the Greek, and there's this great quote in there that where Zorba says, there's one sin that God will not forgive, it is if a beautiful woman tells you to come to her bed and you do not go. And I would think, again, not being an academic, but if you're sort of studying a video game, if that's what you get to do, why? It's a sin that God will not forgive that you not play this game. I guess that's...
Okay, I'm the first one who said, yes, you have to play it. I would say, okay, because for me, I'm coming from the approach that I'm interested in the gamer and his ascribed meanings to games, but of course also to other media. And I would put, for example, of course you have to know the films, you have to know the books, and of course, and this would be the difference to Ian, you have of course asked how the people are ascribing meaning or how they're judging, how they're evaluating this kind of processes. And I'm totally against the so-called armchair anthropologists that being mostly in Europe and not going into the field, and I have to vote for, yes, you have to go into the field. Of course, you don't have to confuse it, because of course you can't take your own experience within the game as a kind of, this is the way how gamer experiences this kind of game. So I'm not for a phenomenological approach, but I have to say, for having methods like interviews, for participant observation, for media questionnaires, and also for visual discourse analysis, you have to know your field. So this is the reason why I would absolutely yes for my research.
Especially among colleagues, not surprisingly, I almost always found the opinion that we must, or more differentiated, shall play the game in order to analyze it, just as much as we need to read a text we want to analyze. The topic, by the way, came up with scholars from various disciplines, including not only religious studies, but also theology, game studies, and literature studies. The one quite hesitant voice in this chorus, which I came across so far, which somewhat critically reflected about the absolute need to play a game before analyzes under any circumstances, also not surprisingly, came from literature studies. One point often taken up as an argument pro the necessity to play a game to analyzes is that playing the game also helps, of course, contextualizing it. It gives the scholar necessary background information and practically helps him or her in the following analysis. But the question remains, how rigorous do we need to demand this? For example, what does play a game actually mean practically? Are we talking about a complete playthrough, or we need to play only a part of the game? If so, which part? Obviously, other than the part chosen for analyzers. Is it enough to play the level in question, the narrative sequence in question, and so on? When speaking about game genres like MMO, BRGs, or open worlds like Minecraft, we would also need to ask, how often do we need to play the game in order to validate our research? Such questions get even more tricky and still need to be modified when it comes to research highlighting not a game per se, for example, analyzing against narrative, but the cultural, social, or technical environment of a game, the game environments. When a scholar is interested in, let's say, comments on a Let's Play gaming video, as I have been in the past, or in the social impact of a game's religious or otherwise general narrative on a religious or otherwise person, group, or community, is it then necessary to play the game, or is it enough to read up on the aspects one is interested in, thus basically relying on second-hand information? despite and to some extent even precisely because of all these, and my understanding partly legitimate questions, I think the answer to whether scholars need to play the game, at least a substantial part of it, to analyze it, I think remains simple. Yes, they do. We need to know our research object as much and deep as possible in order to properly analyze it.
Oh, I get to talk about this?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Everybody. I didn't even know I was going to get to talk about
everybody.
This.
Everybody. So we can vote. Now it's 2-2.
So I feel strongly if the game's available, we should play it. I like this idea about the sin. There are many games we can't play anymore because we don't have emulators for them. We certainly don't have the systems that they were designed to be played in, upright arcade games, or I was speaking to a Russian scholar that the games, that the systems don't exist anymore. So I think the question is it's a mix. You should, if you can, and it's really important to be in the field and hanging out with players and playing the game if you can. And when you can't, what do you do? So one of my backgrounds is in cinema studies as well, and so reconstruct silent film. How much time do I have? Okay, good. So, you know, if we're looking at silent films that are lost, we're reconstructing from photographs, we're looking at interviews, we're trying to look at scripts, we're looking at stills, we're even trying to emulate reproduction of lantern shows. So how can we work in systems of emulation? I think Matthew Kirschenbaum is doing interesting work in this question around film and video games at UMaryland. So I think we'll have to do all of these things. But man, if you're talking about Minecraft and you haven't played Minecraft, why? So I think at that point it does become, would we say an a philologist doesn't have to read ancient manuscripts, or a film scholar doesn't have to watch films. So at that point the question gets a little weird for me. So I would say it's contextual, when and how you can. Oh, the other thing is, if you're doing a long list and you've played 3 games in a genre or 10 games in a genre, and it's the long one at the end of the list, do you really need to play it? You know, maybe not if you're showing a list, but if you're doing real analysis on it, it's really important.
So obviously you need some knowledge of the materials that you're meant to discuss in order to be taken seriously when you discuss. This seems, I think everyone agrees on this, right? So you need some knowledge. Sometimes that involves playing the game. Sometimes it involves some of the other practices that have already been discussed. In some ways it's the wrong question. The question is, in what way do you need to play a game to be able to analyze it? And again, this is my soapbox, I guess, but I would answer this question in the same way I would answer it for almost any discipline, which is that of mild disinterest. And there's this problem in academic disciplines of all kinds, but especially in studies of popular culture, in which we become fans, and anytime you're a fan, it's dangerous waters. This happens in television studies and in other forms of pop cultural study. It happens in films. we're just a bit too much in love with this stuff, and then we sit down with it and we kind of get involved. We get slurp. We go native, basically, into the culture of gaming. And I don't know if this helps us do serious analysis of the works, and also might blind us to some truly interesting questions. One that's relevant to this subject. They just had the author Michael Clune in town. He wrote this nice memoir called Game Life this year, and he has this. It's about growing up in the 80s, playing computer games. And he grows up in this very Catholic house. Goes to Catholic school, and he's not allowed to play Ultima 3 or other games. You know, there's D&D scare in the 80s, sort of pagan representation, and he has to go to his friend's house to play Ultima. He has this kind of weird experience there. But the interesting thing, talking to him at the we did a reading, and you know, talking to him about it, and he was like, yeah, you know, I mean, there's some, it was truth to this. Like, you know, it wasn't the reason. I basically had no relationship with the church anymore. There's lots of reasons for that, but the actual real secularizing functions of computer games, I mean, it's real. That danger, that risk, if you want to perceive it in that way, or that sort of, you know, a release valve or whatever, that's real. And so, you know, a question like what are the you know, what are the secularizing functions of games? I mean, if you truly believe that these are just glorious, wonderful things, and we're playing them all the time, then it's hard to keep your wits about you when you start to ask research questions. So yeah, play them to some extent. Don't become a fan.
I didn't realize I got to answer this question either, so I'm just going to read what I wrote. Definitely maybe. Just as in Minecraft, there are 13 ways of cooking a pork chop, there are at least as many ways of investigating video games and religion, and one can imagine studies that rely on only narrative and our images. Yet if one is to understand Minecraft's procedural rhetoric using a documentary method, researchers are required to put thumbs to controllers and engage in close play. So again, I guess I'm on the yes side. But I don't mind other people doing it their way either. For instance, in Minecraft, only by playing can one truly understand the initial frenzy of appearing in the raw world, of quickly punching wood with one's hands and creating a crafting table, or taking one's first cobblestone pickaxe and creating a shelter with the security of a bed. Only by playing the game can one understand the first terrifying night as one's health drops down to one heart, and one can hear creepers coming to the door, if I had found coal before the sun went down. So that's, and it's kind of interesting, what Ian, and I'm gonna, I don't, hopefully I won't go over my time, it's interesting, Ian talking about game studies, I think it's the same relationship that scholars of religion have to religion, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting,
yeah.
You know, we're not, there's this kind of back and forth, because again, people who study religion tend to either have some problematic relationship to it, right? Because if we were just completely, if we didn't really care about it at all, we would just be doing something else. But it's this kind of, and if we really loved it, we would be in a seminary, maybe, like people, you know what I mean? So, but it's, at least from the AAR perspective and the religious studies perspective, it's that problematic relationship to religion, which I think actually makes a creative tension and makes for good scholarship. And maybe for Ian, it's the same thing with games, right? It's like kind of problematic relationship to them. I'd like to break religion too.
I'm so happy for that story you told, because I changed from religious studies to theology, back to theology. So as a theologian, I can say, no, don't get into bed with that woman. unless
you're married.
Unless you're married to her. But then would you want to publish about that? Basically, I think what I'm going at, and Greg, you actually shot me out of the water before I even stated that. I mean, there's the same thing. I'm just posing. I'm a theologian, so I'm in bed with my religion all the time, right? And I still keep publishing about that. I would still say no, you don't need to play the game, but that is because I am not extremely interested in the game. I'm interested in the player's experience, and actually I'm more interested in changing the player's experience and observing the player playing with the world. You could even say, from my perspective, you cannot even play the game while at the same time analyzing it, because when you analyze the game, it's no longer play, it's just working the rules. And so there's this distinction that you pointed out, Michael, is between playing within the rule set and playing with the rules. And I would always go for playing with the rules to get a greater understanding of what the specific rule set actually is. So I would say, no, you don't need to play the game.
Heidi, do I have 10 seconds? Did I go
take
way over, or could I take 10
time.
Seconds?
Go 10 seconds.
Okay. So I just, because I had written it down, but I forgot. So Fred Goodman in Michigan, who's like one of the early games people in the 70s, did amazing work. He's talked a lot about the importance of spectatorship, so how much you can learn from a game by watching it play. And we've spoken a little bit about that, but I do think it's an important point that I forgot, so I wanted to add that. And I'd also say I'm also a Reform rabbi, so I appreciate being on the edge of these things constantly.
I'd like to now invite Michael Hausman to give, do you have any final comments you'd like to give?
Yeah, no. To be honest, it seems pretty clear. I mean, tension is great. You know, it's good to have this kind of ambiguous relationship, and it depends on what you're interested in and the questions you ask, the degree to which you should play the game. One thing that was talked about in several of the papers, was the importance of bodily involvement and that whole haptic dimension of gameplay. That you just can access without oneself experiencing it, which doesn't mean that one limits oneself to that, or even that one takes that experience as the main kind of avenue of research, but that really does add a very important dimension of engagement. But most of the answers were, you know, yes, but, or no, but, or definitely maybe. What do you think?
We have time for a few questions and responses.
Yeah, Rod Roberts, Florida State University. So this is mostly directed at the nodes, but it really is pretty open. So in my research, when I was trying to ask this question for myself, you know, do I need to play the games to be able to analyze them? I thought about what my alternatives would be, and so I mean, obviously, if I had a friend, which I don't because I'm forever alone. That would work. I could look at a walkthrough via a text walkthrough or a video walkthrough that's very just playing the game, no commentary, but that's mostly focused on gameplay and how to help other players get through the game, not necessarily on the story, which is what I'm looking at. And the most obvious one is a let's play where you have somebody playing or commentating on it, which led me to the question, how do you evaluate how do you analyze the commentary on a game which the narrative, you know, is usually or sometimes a commentary on, you know, other things that the author is doing. Like, how do you evaluate whether it's useful or not in your research? And, like, should you even, is there a point to that? So just sort of like a broad musing sort of question on Let's Plays and their usefulness in games.
No, it wasn't a no.
Yeah, we too did the Let's Plays, and it was, and I think there were much more that make research on Let's Plays, but I would agree with you, because for us the Let's Plays was only one step of the, or one small perspective on the gamers and how they produce other material besides the game, and for example making Let's Plays, how the people react to this, are they discussing about the narratives, or they're mostly they discuss about the Hachi of PewDiePie, to be honest. It was a little bit frustrating, so to speak. Or only, of course, on the technical environment. But I would really stress the first point of your question. And this would be not, I wouldn't be the right addressee. Because how all of you who voted this no, evaluate the significance or relevance of some kind of material, like in the commentaries, like in the discussion forums. Probably it's a kind of, what are you interested in? Of course, I would say yes, but I'm interested in the gamer's perception or in the gamer's ascription process. And for me, it's necessary to know what they're talking about. So I would, you say, but I would go with the no people.
I wanted to ask something, sort of what I would do in that situation, and I probably wouldn't go to the Let's Plays at all, right? And sort of, you know, I gave you my example, sort of study of apocalyptic mythology. What I might do is go to NRA discussion boards and look for gaming threads and see what people are saying there, right, about the connection between their gaming experience and, you know, their mindset, their views about guns, and see if they say anything about apocalypse and that kind of thing. So I would let my topic or my theme guide me and try and think outside the box in terms of what sorts of resources I would use.
But how would you evaluate these commentaries? I'm interested in, because if you're not playing this game, can you really? How do you evaluate this?
Well, my objective is to find the connection, to look at how people articulate that connection, right? If my goal is to suggest that I think that there's something to NRA apocalyptic mythology, it wouldn't hinge completely on the discussion boards either. That would be one part of a larger web that I was weaving. I would also be, you know, analyzing Wayne LaPierre's speeches, right? And so I would be looking at some of the shows that are produced, right?
Yeah, me too, but I think the problem is how could you just evaluate their language, because they are using pictures or motifs or topics from specific games.
Right.
And they make the connection to, for example, apocalypticism.
Right.
And so if I wouldn't play the game and know the narrative,
right,
I wouldn't get the connection to specific topics or pictures.
I might have to go more deeply in that case, right? If there was some particular scene that everyone was talking about, I would have to go learn more about that scene. But that's where the sort of breadcrumbs would lead me. And maybe there's a particular game that I really do need to go play because everyone's talking about it. But maybe there are a few other games that are just being sort of mentioned, right? And so then I can go to sort of get the basic narrative and see how they fit into the larger picture that I'm building. So it really depends on what it is that you're researching. But you're right. There are situations where it would lead me, right, to your research or someone who has gone in more deeply and to perhaps my own play as well. Mm-hmm. But maybe not initially, right?
Okay. The way I understood the question actually was, is a Let's Play, including the comments which are giving by audio mostly, you know, by speech, is it helpful to analyze a game? And I would say you have to really differentiate here, because if you use a Let's Play, that is what is your research object, not the game anymore. And Let's Play is an interpreted game. Mm-hmm. You have to differentiate that. So I would say definitely no. Mm-hmm.
Other questions or responses?
Do you want to?
I'll take it first. just as a caveat, I was a definitely maybe. and so when I study a game, I play the hell out of it. And again, I play it, you know, to the point where I'm tired of playing it. And this is actually similar to when I was doing field work. You know, by the time you're done, you're kind of tired of the place you're in.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, what I do, first of all, I use some of these like new journalism and autoethnography, and they have some techniques to talk about those kind of things. I also see it kind of as a form of close reading and close play, so I mean that's involved in it also. But then I don't just stick to the game, I always branch out and I contextualize it in the greater cultural sphere. Like I would use Let's Play, see how other people played them. What is all the kind of parallel textual stuff that the game designers put out. So it's not a matter of just playing the game and going from there. It's playing the game and then going and then contextualizing it in the field. Mm-hmm. And that's the cultural field. And that's how I would talk about it.
Yeah. Well, it's a little bit similar to Greg, because I wouldn't do, the research object of my research wouldn't be me playing the game. This would be the thing, this is my individual experience. I would use it more in a kind of, if I would go to India and make research there, I have to learn the language, I have to learn the context, I have to learn the culture or tradition they're using. So this would be my first step into this field of gamers who want, for example, with interviews or media questionnaires, so I have a feeling of this field. What is the language? What are the discussion points? What is crucial? And of course, now we come to the interesting question, do you have to play it in a full length? Do you have to play all the different endings? And this would, I would say, it depends a little bit. I mean, I would use it to get to my field, to know my field. And of course, I would also play the different endings if I'm interested in this specific topic. For example, I was conducting research on post-mortality construction, and it was in Beyond Two Souls. And of course, therefore, I have to play the different endings if I'm choosing life or if I'm choosing the other side. So here I would say it depends on my research question.
We have time for one more question and response.
Or are video games just another kind of game?
Yes and no. I find Salen and Zimmerman helpful in terms of talking about specific things that you'll get out of video games that you won't necessarily get out of others. And one of those is the kind of rapidity in feedback that you might get, or the volume in feedback that you might get. They have a set of, I think, 6 or 7 criteria. Short answer, but
Ian's probably got.
Yeah, that's what I'll say. Distract myself in the chairs.
There's a lot going on with computer games. They're computers that are running them, and computers are different from one another, and they're different over their history. And as somebody who spent a lot of time looking at the history of computing and kind of material foundations of games and other kinds of software and specific sorts of computational platforms, that's something that that might be very relevant that you'd miss if you were simply looking at games as games. And there's this computer game, which I'll treat simply as another instance of games. But then the same is true with respect to other domains. You know, these are audiovisual systems. They participate in social practice. You know, so in some ways it's a false question. It's sort of like saying, well, you know, should I study individuals playing games or groups playing games? And, well, I don't know. I mean, it depends. There might be reasons why one would be useful in one context and another context. But kind of getting back to my distrust of game studies, generally speaking, this maneuver that we made in to say there's this field of study of game studies where you can study games as a discipline, as a domain, and the similarities between computer games and Go, that's the important distinction. That maneuver, it has its benefits and it has its blind spots. And so I think that, you know, it's not that important whether you think of your object of study as a game or as a computer game or as a, you know, a social system. What's important is that you're making those choices deliberately for the right reasons and then you get to change your mind at any moment. Say, oh, really, actually, the best way to ask and answer the right question about this thing is this one, right? I think that's the best I could offer. But certainly it's useful to know about computer games in the long history of the millennia-long history of games, generally speaking, only in order that you can open up those avenues of comparative analysis, not in order that we can then sort of say, ah, see how BioShock is, you know, participating in millennia-old history of human creation, and therefore is validated. It's just like Go, really. You know, that would be preposterous.
I'd say that there's two elements of games that are not digital that are important that are not yet shared to digital game. One, of course, is the body that games in the world are more embodied, and so they're open to sort of lots of other sort of levels of communication. And there's something that digital games sort of can't do yet. I think Go is something that maybe digital gaming can sort of get to, in that it is the manipulation of symbols in a fixed space. But something like a riddle game, where you're manipulating game space against what's in your head, is hard. And then the sort of this next level of riddle game, the sort of koan, which is sort of like manipulating the game rules against not only what's in your head, but what's not in your head. This is all very abstract for less than a minute. But there are affordances that digital cannot yet give us. It is really only a subset of games that are about sort of manipulation of symbols within fixed space, and there's other games.
Well, I want to thank the panel and the respondent. We're out of time. I'm sorry. I want to thank the panel for their respondents. I want to thank you for your quick and thoughtful and keeping the time. This has kept the 2 hours going really well. Just 3 things I just want to let you know. First, coming soon to a JAR journal near you is the article Gaming Religion Worlds. This article is an overview of the panel on playing with religion and digital gaming. So many members of the panel, as well as members from that book, are responding on why religious studies should be paying attention to gaming, so echoing a lot of the themes we've heard today. Secondly, I encourage you, we're going to take about a 1-minute break, and then we're going to move swiftly into a business meeting to talk about the future of this session. And finally, if you're interested in studies of media, religion, and culture, and digital gaming, and you are working in this area, I encourage you to consider the
International Society of Media, Religion, and Culture. We have an upcoming conference in Korea, and I've called for papers if you're interested. There's still time to submit till January. This group doesn't sponsor the conference, but they're an active participant and member. Thank you.
I should also add, because this is our inaugural session, I brought some Prosecco.